70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. Throughout the year, we celebrate the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio with the voices of our listeners from all over the world.
KBS 日本語放送のライフワン、お便りモンスター。
Hi, my name is Matsumoto Takuya, aka Letter Monster, an avid listener of KBS World Radio's Japanese service. My radio name Letter Monster comes from the fact that I send letters to KBS World Radio almost every day. I've been listening to KBS World Radio for the past 48 years. I still remember vividly the tense moments when I heard major news stories of our time, such as the assassination of President Park Chung-hee in 1979, the bombing of the Korean Air Flight in 1987, and the bombardment of Yongpyeong Island by North Korea in 2010. The always accurate, fair coverage by KBS World Radio helps me navigate numerous sensitive issues between Korea and Japan, such as the colonial era's comfort women and forced labor, with a balanced perspective. I hope the two countries will continue to move forward hand in hand in the future, and I promise to tune into KBS World Radio's Japanese service for years to come. Thank you.
ありがとうございました。
70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. KBS World Radio brings Korea to you wherever you are.
Hello, it is Thursday and it's the first day of June. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. North Korea slammed the US for condemning the regime's failed satellite launch and pledged that it will put a military spy satellite into space soon. We'll have more in news briefing shortly. Experts continue to remain divided on the safety of Japan's plan to release contaminated wastewater from the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant into the sea, which could take place as soon as the summer. We speak to two experts on both sides of the issue for our in-depth today. And coming up for Explore Korea, we learn about street dance culture in Korea and the upcoming Gwangju Street Culture Festa. Let's begin Korea 24. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, vowed on Thursday that North Korea will successfully put a military spy satellite into orbit soon, a day after its failed launch. She then slammed the United States for condemning Wednesday's launch. Joining us in the studio now is our KBS World Radio news editor, Ku Jin, to brief us on the latest diatribe, as well as our other headlines of the day. Ku Jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So quite a defiant stance from Kim, and despite that failed launch from Wednesday, her statement was carried by the North's official Korean Central News Agency. Can you tell us more about what she said?
Well, Kim Yo-jong said she was confident that the North will successfully deploy a military reconnaissance satellite in space and begin operations in the near future. Kim then denounced Washington's criticism of the North's launch of what it claimed was a space launch vehicle. Kim reportedly said that the U.S. is showing open hostility against North Korea over the launch, which falls within the regime's right to self-defense, adding that the sweeping denouncement by the U.S. and other countries was hypocritical, as they have already launched thousands of satellites. The KCNA separately released photos showing the Cholima-1 rocket lifting off. The latest attempt ended prematurely as the rocket fell into the Yellow Sea after the first stage separation due to a failure in the second stage engine system. The release of photos from a failed launch is considered rare for Pyongyang. Insiders speculate that the regime chose to promptly acknowledge the failure and release the images to show that the rocket was clearly not carrying a warhead nor a weapon system.
Well, regardless of its success or failure, North Korea's repeated missile tests and launches have recently ramped up tensions on the peninsula. And in an apparent response, South Korea also announced on Thursday that it had successfully tested a homegrown missile interceptor capable of taking out high-altitude ballistic missiles. Can you tell us more?
Well, the state-run Agency for Defense Development said on Thursday that the successful test with the long-range surface-to-air missile took place at its Anhung test site in Taehan, South Chungcheong Province, on Tuesday. The agency revealed the entire testing process, including missile tracking and interception at a target altitude, in the third successful test of four since last November. A key element of the Korea air and defense missile defense, the three-stage LSAM, featuring the final kill vehicle stage equipped with an infrared seeker, is capable of shooting down an incoming ballistic missile at an altitude of 50 to 60 kilometers. The KAMD also consists of the U.S. Patriot Advanced Capability 3 missile and South Korea's Cheongung 2 medium-range surface-to-air missile for interception at altitudes of 40 kilometers or lower. The military plan to complete LSAM development by next year before starting mass production in 2025 and deploying the interception system in the late 2020s.
Let's move on now to the economy. Exports from South Korea continue to lag compared to last year as May posted the eighth straight month of decline. The anemic semiconductor and petroleum product sectors outweighed poor imports to extend the trade deficit streak to its 15th month. So can you break down the latest trade figures for us?
Well, South Korea's exports fell for the eighth month in May as the sluggish demand for semiconductors continued. Data released by Ministry of Trade, Industry and Energy on Thursday showed a 15.2% drop in exports compared to last year, with total value at $52.24 billion. The figures extend the downward spiral to its eighth month, the longest streak since the outbound shipments maintained a decline from December 2018 to January 2020. The chip sector felt the hardest blow as it saw overseas sales plummet by more than 36%. Petroleum products also took a hit in May, falling by 33% over last year. The weak figures accounted for reduced shipments headed for all six major markets, including China, the US, and member states of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, compared to a year earlier. Imports, meanwhile, also fell by 14% over last year at $54.34 billion. Despite the drop, however, the inbound and outbound figures mean that the nation posted a trade deficit of $2.1 billion in May, the 15th straight month the balance was in the red since March of last year. The persistent deficit is the longest in 27 years since logging a negative balance for over two whole years in the lead-up to the Asian financial crisis of 1997. In the face of such a streak, however, the ministry appeared optimistic about prospects for the rest of the year, noting that the deficit has consistently shrunk since the beginning of the year, while daily exports have been improving.
Meanwhile, in more hopeful news, the seven-day mandatory quarantine for COVID-19 patients and the mask mandate at pharmacies and clinics are no more as of Thursday today. Can you give us a recap on what this means on day one of the transition?
Well, the national crisis level for the virus was lowered to an alert level from the highest serious level as of 12 a.m. Thursday, 3 years and 4 months after the nation reported its first COVID-19 case on January 20th, 2020. With the transition to endemic status, the required COVID-19 isolation period of 7 days is now reduced to a recommendation of five. Most of the remaining face mask regulations have also been lifted, except in nursing homes and inpatient hospitals. PCR tests are no longer recommended for those arriving in the country. Given that concerns of infections remain, the government will continue to provide free COVID-19 vaccinations and free medicine to treat the infectious disease.
In other news, Halt Children's Services has appealed a Seoul court ruling that ordered it to pay 100 million won in damages to an internationally adopted plaintiff for his deportation from his new home country decades after his relocation. Can you explain?
Well, the Seoul-based adoption agency announced the move in a press conference on Thursday, asking the court to reassess how long its custodial duties should have extended in the 1979 adoption of the South Korean-born plaintiff to the U.S. This comes after the Seoul Central District Court ruled in favor of adoptee Adam Krapsa in mid-May, recognizing the defendant's gross negligence in failing to ensure the child's acquisition of a new nationality in his adoptive country. Krapsa, whose Korean name is Shin Song-hyuk, filed a 200 million won suit against Holt and the government in 2019. The court ruled that Holt failed in its duty to protect Krapsa and his guardian, pointing out that the agency was not aware of that failure. The plaintiff also appealed against the court's ruling, pressing the court to further recognize the government's liability.
And finally, the International Atomic Energy Agency has endorsed the accuracy and precision of measurements by the operator of Japan's crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant of treated water to be discharged into the sea.
Well, the IAEA gave the assessment in its latest report on Wednesday after comparing analysis of identical samples by the Tokyo Electric Power Company and third-party laboratories, saying that there was no detection of any additional radionuclides at significant levels. The UN watchdog said that TEPCO has demonstrated a high level of accuracy in their measurements and technical competence, and its sample collection procedures follow the appropriate standards required to obtain representative samples. The IAEA said the samples taken for the report were analysed by TEPCO, as well as three IAEA laboratories and third-party facilities in France, South Korea, Switzerland and the US. The IAEA plans to release its final report before Japan proceeds with the discharge.
We'll be talking more about this controversial plan for our in-depth next, but first we wrap up our news briefing here. Heejin, thank you for bringing us the updates.
Thank you.
The head of the South Korean inspection team that visited the Fukushima nuclear power plant last week held a press conference on Wednesday. He said that they had extensively inspected key equipment that were used to discharge the contaminated wastewater from the crippled plant into the sea, but he added that further analysis is needed to conclude on the safety of the plan. Experts have remained divided on the controversial plan. The plant, despite it being decommissioned after the 2011 earthquake and tsunami, is still producing some 100 cubic meters of radioactive wastewater a day, a byproduct of efforts to keep the melted reactors cool. Japan says storage of the water is now approaching capacity and that they will have to release it, but Tokyo has assured the public that the water has been adequately treated. To discuss the safety of the planned water release, we'll be speaking to two experts in back-to-back interviews now who have contrasting views on the plan. We'll be speaking to Dr. Robert Richmond from the University of Hawaii at Manoa a bit later. But first, we have Professor Wade Allison from Oxford University. He is a renowned expert in electromagnetic radiation, and he is the author of a book published in 2009 called Radiation and Reason, The Impact of Science on a Culture of Fear. He joins us on the line now. Professor Allison, thank you for your time today.
Hello.
Let me start with something you've said previously about Japan's wastewater release plan. You said that you have no doubt at all that people do not have to worry about the wastewater and that you can think of no particular effect from the treated wastewater on the human body, likening the effects of the wastewater as having a CT scan or medical x-rays. Can you expand on this for us and how you are sure that it's safe?
There are two questions. One is, what would the effect of the radiation be on the human body? And that I am quite sure about because I compare it, for instance, as I did when I was in Seoul, with the radioactivity which is in our blood and in our bodies all the time. And that is much larger than the effect of the would be the effect of drinking the water. I mean, I'm talking about drinking the water undiluted. When it's diluted in the sea, it's even more harmless. The other question, of course, is whether you trust, whether you're happy with what the Japanese say. And there, the important thing is what the IAEA say. And the IAEA, I understand, have consulted experts in Switzerland and France and Korea as well, and places or other laboratories around the world. So you don't have to trust Japan. Japan has checked with the IAEA, and they, as I understand it, have reported before and are about to report again before the end of June. Is that right? So I don't think the Japanese, the Korean people, have anything to worry about.
Well, Japan have a plan to try and treat the wastewater to ensure that there's no risk of harm to humans with the planned release. Can you explain a bit more for us about what we know about Japan's plan, how it works exactly, and how confident you are that it will improve the situation?
Well, of course, the important thing is that the Alps plan removes radioactivity from the water chemically, and for strontium and cesium and other radioactive elements in the water, that can be done, as I say, chemically. But tritium is the same chemically as hydrogen, the hydrogen which is in water anyway, and it is exceedingly difficult to remove. It's also exceedingly harmless. But what I did when I was in your country the other week was to compare it, as I say, with the radioactivity of a CT scan or that we have in our blood and is all around us anyway. And on that basis, I was able to say that I would be happy to drink a litre of the water, and I know it would be harmless.
You say that, but the concern I think a lot of people that have is that there's perhaps no real precedent for this kind of situation. The concern is that if there are unusually high concentrations of radioactive water accumulating somewhere in the ocean, we don't know what kind of effects really that will have on the fish and other sea creatures, and how that can make its way up the food chain for human consumption as well. Risks overall may not be high, but the question is, shouldn't we ensure that the risk is zero, or at least make sure that we know that there is a little risk?
There is no such thing as zero risk. We take a risk every time we get out of bed in the morning. If you really want to avoid risk, you can stay in bed. We have to engage in risk when we cross the road, when we go out in a car, whatever we do. We've known about radioactivity for 120 years since Marie Curie did a lot of very hard work on the subject and got two Nobel Prizes and showed us how to use radiation for medicine, for CT scans and all that sort of thing, although that the technology actually came afterwards. But she did all the hard work and lived out her full life expectancy and died when she was 67. So this is not a new technology. It is not a new problem. It's not something we don't know about. And there are laboratories all around the world who have been consulted by the IAEA to check out that what is happening in Japan, what the Japanese are proposing, is sensible and will remove all possible cause for concern.
You say it's up to the IAEA to make sure that what Japan are proposing is being carried out. But one of the major criticisms about how Japan has handled this situation is the lack of transparency from Tokyo. There's question marks about how much access the IAEA have had as well. How certain are you of Tokyo's claims? And are you,
why? I mean, Japan would have egg on its face if it fell out with the IAEA. That would be very stupid of them. There would be no suggestion that the IAEA are not being satisfied with the precautions that have been taken. So, I mean, this whole Fukushima thing is extraordinary. Nobody has had their health impacted by the by this accident. It was an accident in which three nuclear reactors were written off, but it was not a health accident at all. The evacuation was unnecessary. The evacuation, in fact, caused serious harm and itself caused serious harm and mental health of people in Japan was affected by fear of the radiation. But radiation is all around us, and as I say, if you don't like that sort of thing, you know, should can stay in bed in the morning.
So is there any comparison with, say, another famous meltdown that we've had in history before, the Chernobyl meltdown? Obviously, that has had effects. So our fears about meltdowns and about what happened in Fukushima, I think, stems from that incident.
Yep, but, I mean, the number of people who died from that was pretty small. I mean, you know, it's things like the Korean ferry disaster, which we have to learn about, learn from, and that was telling people, informing people what is going on. And we've had accidents in the UK as well with fire at the Grenfell Tower disaster. But nobody died from the radiation at Fukushima. And that was 12 years ago. So this is not, this is the end of the story. It's the end of the story in which there have been no deaths from radiation at all. The number of people who died at Chernobyl, people thought they were going to be hundreds of thousands, but in fact it was less than 50. Mm. And that's pretty well known. But there were a lot of people who were very frightened, and fear can actually kill people. People get very depressed and worried, and they drink and get marriage break up and so on. These are serious problems caused by fear of radiation. And I don't think the Korean people should have fear of this water.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us on this today. We appreciate your insights. We've been talking to Professor Wade Allison from Oxford University. Thank you once again for your time. Let's get a different view on this situation now. Joining us on the line is Dr. Robert Richmond, who is the director of the Kualo Marine Laboratory at the University of Hawaii in Manoa. He also gave a report on his concerns over the wastewater release plan to the South Korean National Assembly earlier this year. We connect with him now. Dr. Richmond, thank you for speaking to us today.
Oh, thanks very much for the opportunity.
Can we start with your overall assessment of Japan's contaminated water release plan? What do you make of it?
Well, I'm one of five members of a expert scientific panel that was engaged by the Pacific Island Forum. So we've been studying this for about a year and a half now. And I would say that at very best, it's premature. And at very least, that it's ill-advised. At the moment, we've been reviewing many documents. We were on a three-hour call today with Japan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, representatives from the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, and representatives from the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO. And we've been working through discussions and questions about their plan. And many of our questions still remain unanswered. There are data gaps that are very concerning. There are areas in which the data are actually demonstrating that this is not a good plan going forward. And we've also been trying to be proactive in examining other options other than the release of the treated contaminated water into the Pacific Ocean. And so far, that's met with very little interest from the Japanese. So we remain concerned, and our job is to be able to provide accurate and adequate information to the Pacific Island leaders on the safety of this planned process for the disposal of the treated water. And at this point, we still see many gaps that have not been addressed that cause us concern.
Right. So when you say it's premature and advised, you're saying that we just don't know enough yet.
Correct. There are some very important gaps there. One of the examples we went through today is the radiological environmental impact assessment. It's a formal document that should address many of the key concerns about what the potential impacts could be on the ocean and on the people who depend on the ocean. Some of the experiments that are set up are poorly designed. They're not answering the fundamental questions we need to know. They don't provide the level of resolution that one would expect from a document of this importance. And that's one of the reasons why we remain very concerned. There are 62 radionuclides in total that we're concerned about. They've addressed several, but many of the ones that we're very concerned about are problematic still. And as a result, we continue to try to reach out to them and get the data that we need. But so far, it's not been to the level that we would expect or hope for.
There are, of course, concerns about the effects on marine life and how radiation could possibly enter the food chain and ultimately end up to a human exposure as well. In your view, what's the likelihood of a human exposure to the radiation after Japan's release of the wastewater into the sea? We have spoken to someone who said that the wastewater effects, the potential effects, is perhaps no worse than having a CT scan or medical x-rays.
Yeah, well, once again, it's the way in which people are presenting or misrepresenting the data. We hear platitudes all the time, like you'll get more radiation flying on an airplane from Seoul to New York than you would from what they're being proposed. And it's important to realize there's a big difference between an external exposure to certain radionuclides, especially the beta emitters, versus internal exposure that you would get from eating a contaminated fish. I'm a marine biologist by training, but I spent 2 years at Eniwetok Atoll in the Marshall Islands, which was the testing site for the U.S. for the nuclear testing program of the 1950s. And studies I was involved of tracked the uptake and accumulation of radionuclides into fish, into plants, and as a result, into people. And so an external exposure for a beta emitter, in this case tritium, is one of the radionuclides of concern, in that tritium cannot be removed from what they're calling their advanced liquid processing system, or their ALPS. Even though it's a low-level beta emitter, it can become organically bound. It can become trophically transferred, meaning going from plants to animals. And then if people eat these organisms, whether it's a bivalve or a fish, or a crustacean like a lobster, then in fact it can be taken internally, and that's quite different. Beta emitters, like at the level the tritium releases, it can be blocked by skin and clothing and even paper, but once they get inside, there is no protection for the cells, and ionizing radiation can cause DNA damage. Getting at the cell level, it can affect DNA, RNA, there are proteins that are incredibly important in cells that transfer key information. We call them signaling proteins. And so it can occur at cellular levels, and then it can occur affecting individual organisms. So this is one of our concerns, is if, in fact, these radionuclides are getting into the environment. One of the ways in which it's being promoted is the old adage, the solution to pollution is dilution. And that's not the case at all in the ocean. If the ocean were, in fact, a sterile glass aquarium, you could just go with the pure chemistry. and many of the chemical analyses that have been provided are spot on. We're not arguing with the calculations about millisieverts and other levels. What we are concerned about is that once you put radionuclides into the ocean, they interact with plants, including the microscopic plants that are at the base of the food web, phytoplankton. They can be filtered by clams and oysters, bivalves. They can be taken up by fish larvae, and accumulated. Following the disaster in 2011, in that year, tuna caught off of the San Diego coast of California were found with cesium that could be traced back to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Mm. The levels were extremely low, but these are concerns, is that if it's being taken up and if it's being transported, the leaders of the Pacific Island Forum are absolutely correct to be concerned, to ask the question, is this possibly going to affect them, the health of the ocean and the health of the people who depend on the ocean?
Can you explain a bit more? What happens if humans are exposed to this radiation? What are the risks in a, let's say, worst-case scenario?
So there's two types of biological effects that are described for radiation. Once again, it depends on the kind of emitter. Gamma rays are the ones that have the highest energy. Beta are lower. But in one way, it turns out that beta emitters may have more of a biological effect in that they don't penetrate all the way through the way a gamma ray would, but rather they can get lodged and continue to affect cells for longer periods of time. We have one study that we reviewed that showed that tritium that was organically bound was found in livers of fish with a half-life of over 500 days, so close to 2 years. And during that period of time, the beta emitters can, in fact, affect cells, everything from the DNA and the RNA to the signaling proteins. And so these are concerns then about how the exposure occurs, the amount of energy involved, the length of the exposure, and the two ways in which these biological effects are described are stochastic effects. Those are tied primarily to cancer, meaning that there's a chance you'll get it, but you don't know exactly what that chance is. And the epidemiology of cancer is very, very difficult to parse out, meaning that up to 50% of people will have cancer of some sort during their lives. That's not overestimate, but rather kind of a pragmatic view of the world. And the question always is what amount of cancer could be attributed to low-dose exposure for periods of time? So those are what we call the stochastic by-chance events. Then there's the ones called deterministic, and those are the ones that we remain very concerned about, as well as the cancers. And that is damage to cells, damage to tissues, damage to organisms. And it's not about death. We do a lot of ecotoxicology in our laboratory, and our catchphrase is death is a rather crude estimator of stress. There are many things that can compromise the health and the function of an organism or a person far short of death, but sure. It does affect the quality of life, and it does affect everything from the immune system to metabolism. And these are the deterministic effects that we are concerned about, that if some of these radionuclides get taken up, ingested, then they can be problematic.
I understand that earlier this year in January, in that report I mentioned earlier that you and other experts were involved in, that was delivered to the South Korean National Assembly as well. You said that the data Japan provided was prejudiced in concluding the safety of the water release plan. You specifically pointed out that continued use of the ocean for dumping waste is not sustainable and that alternatives are needed at this point. You also said that Japan has the opportunity to be the world's leader in advancing new approaches to this serious international problem. Can you elaborate more on what you said?
Absolutely. And so when we talk about ocean health, we're not talking about starting with a blank canvas. We're looking at oceans that are already under a great amount of stress from a variety of areas. Ocean pollution, everything from plastics to mercury to pesticides. We're in a world of climate change, ocean acidification, elevated seawater temperatures. There are other problems in terms of overfishing and overexploitation. So the oceans are already in a lot of trouble, and that's a big part of the work that I do is studying human effects on ocean health. and the connection then between ocean health and the people who depend on it, the human health. So when we look at oceans that are already under stress from a variety of different areas, this is one more level of stress at a time when we should be reducing stressors to the ocean. There's a general consensus that ocean health is being compromised from human-induced disturbance. As I mentioned, everything from pollution to climate change to overexploitation. And so, you know, pretending that this is only radionuclides and that it should be looked at in a vacuum is incorrect. And so continuing to use the ocean as the ultimate receptacle for all kinds of human-induced stressors is simply the wrong way to be going. This is the United Nations Ocean Decade, the people of the Pacific, and I really do credit the leaders from Pacific Island Forum for being so proactive and not only looking at the state of the oceans today, but in looking at the legacy that they leave for their children and generations to come. And this is why I think this is a very big concern. This is not going to be a one-time release over a short period of time. It's going to take at least 30 years. And so our estimates that it could take even longer than that. And if you consider the decommissioning that is being planned for the three cores that are in meltdown, this raises further questions that this is not only transboundary, which has huge implications in terms of law of the sea. The radionuclides are not going to stay around Japan or in the Japanese coast. They'll be transported by currents. They'll be transported by fish. They'll be transported even by plastics. Turns out PET plastics have been found to transport radionuclides across the ocean. So here we are looking at an ocean under stress. We're looking at people that are already at risk from the loss of ocean resources. The people of the Pacific are directly being affected by all of these impacts that they're not responsible for. And here we have a situation where the people of the Pacific did nothing to cause the problem, yet they have nothing to gain from this dumping of the contaminated water and everything to lose.
Dr. Richmond, we only have less than a minute left, but what suggestions do you have for Tokyo and TEPCO, and how do you think South Korea and other related countries should demand from Japan at this point?
Exactly what you mentioned, the other point. It's a tragedy that occurred, and we feel terrible for the people of Japan and all who are affected, but it's also an opportunity to change the trajectory and the way in which events like this are handled. This is not the first, nor will it be the last. And so Japan has the opportunity to be a world leader in how nuclear waste is handled, how incidents like this are controlled. And we really hope that Japan will take a leadership position. The argument that, well, other people dump tritium and other radionuclides into the ocean from existing power plants, that's quite a bit different than dealing with the nuclear disaster here. But other people's bad behavior is really not an excuse for additional bad behavior. And we're really hoping that the Japanese government will reevaluate what they're doing, that will get more support from the International Atomic Energy Agency to examine this as an opportunity to change the way in which these incidents are handled.
Well, we'll have to wrap it up there. We've been speaking to Dr. Robert Richmond from the Kualo Marine Laboratory at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. We appreciate your thoughts on this issue today.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update.
The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 7.95 points, or 0.31% on Thursday, to close the day at 2,569.17. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ rose, however, gaining 6.84 points, or 0.80%, to close at 863.78. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 5.61 against the U.S. dollar, closing the day at 1,321.61.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, let's turn to our daily segment, Korea Trending, where we round up some of the other news stories that have been trending online today. And for that, we have with us our contributor, Diane Yu. Diane, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Daniel.
Let's head straight into the first story. What do you have for us first?
We start with quite an amazing story. It was belatedly revealed that a South Korean man was rescued by Qatar authorities. Around 24 hours later, he fell from a ship into the sea. According to Qatar's Ministry of Interior and the Korean Embassy in Qatar on Wednesday, a male sailor in his 20s fell into the sea on the night of May 23rd from a commercial vessel passing through the waters near Doha. Qatar conducted conducted a large-scale search operation using the Air Force, Navy, and Coast Guard, and they were able to find and rescue the man the next day.
Wow, 24 hours at sea. That's incredible.
Right.
How was the man able to survive for so long?
The sailor is said to have found a floating object while in the sea and held onto it to keep afloat.
Right.
Qatar's Ministry of Interior explained that, quote, the rescued Korean was immediately taken to Hamad Hospital in Doha for proper treatment, end quote. Local media reported that the man was in the sea for a long time, but was able to survive thanks to the water's warm temperature, which was 27 degrees Celsius.
Wow, okay, so that's very fortunate indeed.
Right.
You mentioned that the sailor was taken to hospital for treatment. Mm-hmm. How is he doing? Will he be in hospital for long?
No, he will not. The man was discharged after 2 days of treatment. He is said to be returning back to Korea soon. The Korean embassy in Qatar said that it thanked the Qatari government for its swift and active search. And the Korean ambassador to Qatar, Lee Jun-ho, said that this will deepen and strengthen the friendship between the two countries.
Well, it's amazing work by Qatari authorities.
Of course.
And well done to the man as well for not panicking and not giving up
as
well.
Yeah, for sure.
An incredible story to start our trending segment off today. Let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
Summers in South Korea can cause serious issues because of the season's high temperatures and humidity. And in order to prevent students and school staff from falling ill due to the weather, the Ministry of Education announced on Thursday that it will strengthen heat wave prevention measures. Under these measures, schools may shortens classes, adjust arrival and departure times, or even close when a summer heat wave warning is issued.
Right, this comes after the Korea Meteorological Administration announced that this year's summer would be hotter than usual, right?
That's right, unfortunately. The KMA predicted a 40% chance that the average temperature between June and August this year would be higher than normal. In Korea, a heat wave advisory is issued when the highest apparent temperature is 33 degrees Celsius for more than 2 days. Apparent temperature is the temperature perceived by humans caused by the combined effects of air temperature, humidity, and wind. In addition, a heat wave warning is issued when the temperature is expected to continue above 35 degrees Celsius and if damage from the weather is expected.
Okay, so when the advisory or warning is issued, what should the schools do?
When an advisory is issued, schools must refrain from outdoor activities such as sports and BE classes. And when the heat wave warning is raised, all sports activities must be stopped. Schools have to come up with an alternative plan to substitute outdoor classes as well. Also, schools need to teach their students what to do in order to prevent any heat-related illnesses, such as drinking water regularly, walking in the shade, and protecting their skin with proper sunblock.
Hopefully the schools won't have to take such extreme measures as having to close entirely, but it seems we do need to brace for a hot summer this year. Okay, let's turn to our final story. What do you have for us?
We just discussed how the Korea Meteorological Administration predicted a hotter summer than usual this year. Well, the KMA has also predicted that there will be heavy rain in the Korean peninsula this summer as well. Mm. And during the rainy season, there are several essential items we need to help us stay dry. For example, umbrellas and raincoats. And many around the country are reading about one item in particular that saw its sales skyrocket last month ahead of the monsoon season in Korea, which is rain boots.
Right. So our final topic is not about rain, but about rain boots.
Yes.
How much of an increase in sales are we talking about?
According to a South Korean fashion platform W Concept on Wednesday, sales of rainy season items such as rain boots and aqua shoes saw more than a 15 times increase in the month of May compared to the same period last year. In particular, the best-selling product was rain boots and sales increased by nearly 2,000%. The popularity of rain boots has been greatly influenced by the KMA's prediction that there will be heavy rain due to the El Nino phenomenon. El Nino is the warm phase of the Pacific Ocean's temperature cycle. The KMA predicted that El Nino would develop from May to July, a month earlier than originally expected, and it would result in harsher weather conditions.
Right, so I can understand why people are opting to purchase these items if rain is expected.
Right.
But still, that's quite a steep jump. Do we know if there are any other explanations for the recent rain boots craze?
So previously, rain boots were considered a fashion accessory that's worn only by women, but people's perception has changed. The number of male customers looking for the item has significantly increased. Also, having many different choices of design and color has contributed to the sales hike. The existing monotone boot colors such as navy, blue, or black, have been diversified to something more colorful like yellow, green, and pink. Mm. And as there are more options to choose from, the South Korean fashion platform explained that consumers are buying more than just one pair of boots.
Right, so it looks like 2023 is going to be the year of rain boots.
Yes, more the merrier.
Okay, we're going to leave it there for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Diane, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Time now for us to discover more about Korea and the historical, cultural, and travel highlights that the country has to offer in our weekly segment, Explore Korea. And this week we have our travel explorer, Hannah Roberts, with us once again, ready to introduce us to another place to visit on the peninsula. Hannah, hello. It's great to see you again.
Good to see you too.
Okay, so where are you taking us today?
This time we're actually leaving Seoul and we're heading south to the city of Gwangju in the South Jeolla province. Mm. It's a city that is, you know, probably most famous for its tragic history and very strong people, but that's not why we're going there today. This time I want to introduce an upcoming event, which is the brand new Gwangju Street Culture Festival.
Okay, that sounds interesting. What's it all about?
It's all about street dance. Actually.
Right, okay.
So street dance is a very popular pastime in Korea, both taking part in it and watching it. And for the first time ever, Gwangju will be hosting a whole festival dedicated to the sharing of and participation in the culture of Korean street dance. Mm. It's being hosted by the famous dance crew from Gwangju called Bigol, which was founded in 2013. And it's composed of talented members from various different dance disciplines, including multiple time award and competition winners and participants from national dance TV shows.
Right.
Big Goyle has hosted a national street dance competition every year since 2014, which is called Battle Lineup. But this year, the crew is partnering with Gwangju City to host a brand new festival.
Wow, that sounds exciting. I have to admit, I'm not sure if you know this, but street dance is actually a topic close to my heart.
It is?
Or at least breaking is, aka okay. Breakdancing, because I used to be a b-boy myself.
You were a b-boy, in my youth. Way.
Yes, which feels like several lifetimes ago now already. So I'm excited to learn more about the events that they have in store for us at this festival. But for people who might not know, could you first tell us more about street dance culture in Korea? You said it's a very popular pastime in Korea, but there's a really big scene here.
There is, yeah. So, I mean, you probably know a lot more than I do about it, but I'll try and do my best. So when I first came to Korea 10 years ago, I actually had no idea that street dance was as popular as it is. Mm. In fact, Korea are world leaders in the street dance scene, I'd say, having had Korean crews win world street dance competitions several times. In recent years, street dance has also taken over the small screen here in Korea. With street dance competition shows such as Street Woman Fighter, Street Dance Girls Fighter, which is the high school girls crew dance show, as well as Be Ambitious, which is one where they formed a male street dance crew, and Street Man Fighter, which was the male street dance crew
competition
show.
Yeah.
All proving super popular and creating household names of their participants. And propelling some groups to fame online as well. One of those, 1 Million, a dance crew and dance studio based in Seoul, has over 26 million subscribers on YouTube.
Wow.
And also the crew Just Jerk, who became famous overseas, actually, after performing on TV show America's Got Talent. And they became even better known domestically after winning the latest street dance show in Korea.
Yes, street dance, it's been popular in Korea for a very long time,
yes.
But it is seeing a particularly strong boom at the moment, thanks to some of those TV shows you talked about. And it seems people are getting involved more than ever.
Yeah, there are countless dance studios in Korea offering classes for people of all levels. Me too. So I could join if I wanted to.
Sure.
And also, sometimes in English, visiting studios like 1 Million for a dance class has become a really desirable thing to do for people just traveling here. You know, Korea's no joke when it comes to street dance, and people want to learn from some of the best.
Right. It's sort of a package holiday deals that they offer sometimes. So it's even helping boost tourism in Korea, it seems then. So let's go back to that festival in Gwangju. Can you tell us more about it?
Sure. The Gwangju Street Culture Festa, or festival, is being held for the very first time this year from June 9th to June 11th. It's being hosted at the Asia Culture Center Arts Theatre and is a collaboration event, like I said earlier, compiling Pikko's battle lineup competition with Gwangju City's fringe festival event, Street Dance on Stage.
Mm.
There are over 1,200 participants that will take part in the competition part of the festival. And some of those are also from overseas, not just Korean people. And there are several famous dancers who will make guest appearances at the competition, including Baek Gu-young, YBX, and Ambitious, which is the group formed by the show Be Ambitious that I mentioned earlier.
Sure.
The Street Dance on Stage event, which is also being held at the Asia Culture Center in the Hanul Madang, will showcase 35 shortlisted dance crews who applied online from across the country, including both adult groups and youth groups.
Mm.
Of course, there will also be shopping opportunities. It is a festival in Korea, as well as a dining area with food trucks there to serve up participants and attendees. I'm pretty sure all that dancing will be hungry work, so they'll be well visited, I'm sure.
Yes, I imagine they would, even for those just watching as well. It sounds like there's a lot going on, so it sounds pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
How can we attend if we are interested in making our way down to Gwangju for this event?
So you'll be pleased to know attendance is free. But it is expected that the finals in particular will draw a large crowd, and so seats for the finals or entry passes to the finals are limited to 700 people only.
Okay.
You can sign up for a ticket to the final on a Google form linked on the Battle Lineup Instagram page, which you can find by searching lineup_battle and clicking the link below their bio and choosing the first link, which says Lineup 8 Performance Side.
Mm.
The information on that link is also there in English. So if you don't read Korean, you don't need to worry. You can still go. The final is at 5 p.m. on June 11th, but the other open performances are being held on the 10th and 11th. So there are lots of chances to see some action if you don't get a ticket for that final bit.
Of course, the final would be the highlight, but I've been to these sorts of events. Just being at the festival, there'll be plenty to experience and see, and I'm sure there'll be lots that people can enjoy anyway, even if you don't get tickets for the finals.
Definitely.
It's worth checking out, even if you don't get that ticket. Finally, how can we get there? What's the best way to get to Gwangju?
So the best way to get to Gwangju from Seoul is probably by KTX, like the most direct and fastest.
Sure.
Once you get there, the Asia Culture Center is located right next to 518 Democracy Square. If you're taking public transport after you arrive, or even if you live there already, then the subway is the best way to get there, as it's located directly outside the provincial office subway stop. If you're coming in by train from elsewhere in Korea, it's just a 10-minute taxi ride from Gwangju Station or 20 minutes on the bus.
Yes, talking about the May 18th Democracy Square, of course, there's so much else to see in Gwangju as well. There's so much history and culture. So it's definitely worth a trip down, even if it's not for the festival.
Oh, yeah. Always worth a trip to Gwangju.
Definitely. Yes, it sounds like something I'd enjoy definitely as well.
I think so.
I wouldn't want to get involved myself.
As, stop yourself from getting up on stage.
Well, I'm pretty sure I'd hurt myself.
You get jumpy legs.
If I were to jump in again now. So yes, perhaps probably best to leave it to others. We'll wrap it up there, Hannah. Thank you for that. We appreciate it as always. Till next time, take care. And we'll see you again soon.
See you soon.
Did you enjoy this segment? You can discover more segments like this throughout the week on Korea 24. On Monday, we bring you news from the world of sports around the peninsula. Then on Tuesday, notable guests from various fields join us and give us insight into their lives and work. Are you a fan of books? Then tune in on Wednesday for Korea Book Club, where our book critic helps us unpack works by Korean authors or written on Korea. Go on an adventure with us every Thursday as we take a look at Korea's hidden gems with Explore Korea. And on Friday, listen to what our film critics have to say about the latest movie releases from both home and abroad. We have all that you need, all in one place, on Korea 24.
We've come to our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And to bring us those stories, we have with us our staff editor, Richard Larkin, who has been looking through those papers for us. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you too.
Okay, so what's the first story that you have for us today?
I have chosen Park Yuna's article in the culture section of the Korea Herald. Artworks from the National Gallery in London arrived in Seoul this week and will be on display at the National Museum of Korea. A total of 52 paintings will be shown at the exhibition called Eyes on Us, Masterpieces from the National Gallery London, and the article goes into detail about the works.
Wow, so artworks all the way from London here, yes, in Seoul. Okay, so why have the works made their way to Korea exactly?
So it's part of the National Gallery's tour across Asia. The collection of paintings is said to encompass the Renaissance, Baroque, and post-impressionism from the early 20th century. The works are from renowned artists, including Raphael, Rembrandt, Monet, and Van Gogh. A total of 50 paintings can be found in four different sections of the exhibition, which is meant to show how Western artists' perspectives shifted from God to humans and their surroundings.
Mm.
One painting that was mentioned in particular was Van Gogh's Long Grass with Butterflies. It was actually created when the artist was hospitalized due to mental illness.
Wow, it sounds like a fantastic opportunity for our listeners in Korea to see some of these important paintings without having to travel all the way to the UK.
Right.
How long will the exhibition run for?
So the paintings will be on display until October 9th, so there is quite a bit of time left.
Okay, let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
Well, the next article I mainly chose so that I could say this on air, Shiny's back. Dong Sunhwa's article in the Hallyu section of the Korea Times explains that the K-pop group SHINee will release its 8th studio album, Hard, on June 26. The group also celebrates the 15th anniversary of its debut this year.
Yes, if you've listened to K-pop songs from the late 2000s, then you probably know, familiar with this second-generation K-pop group. SHINee is one of the marquee names in the industry, right, with hits including Ring Ding Dong, Lucifer, and Sherlock. So can you tell us more about the group's plan to celebrate 15 years then already?
Sure. On top of the album, the group held a special event for fans from May 27th to the 28th in Seoul. SHINee will also hold its 6th standalone concert, Perfect Illumination, in Seoul from June 23rd to the 25th. This will be the first time the veteran singers will perform live for local fans in almost 7 years. Then the album comes out on June 26th. The group's leader, Onyu, hinted that the 8th album will signal a new chapter in the group's career. It will be interesting to see how different the tracks are compared to previous songs.
Mm, indeed. And what about the other members? What do they have to say about the long-awaited comeback?
So one of the members, Minho, said recently that it feels surreal to celebrate 15 years. He added that he is happy and thankful that he is able to keep the dream he has had since high school going. Another member, Taemin, said that SHINee's fans are loyal and that they have witnessed their growth. He also thinks that the fans keep the group in their hearts like school memories.
Indeed, okay. We'll wrap it up there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Richard, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
And that's where we wrap up our show. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. So we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.
Don't even think about checking that message or texting back. Did you know it only takes 3 seconds after a driver's attention has been diverted from the road for a crash to occur? Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident than driving under the influence of alcohol. Sending or reading a text message causes drivers, on average, to take their eyes off the road for 5 seconds. When driving at 80 kilometers per hour, that means that drivers travel approximately the length of a football field with their eyes closed. At KBS World Radio, we value our listeners' safety and well-being. If you're listening to our programs while driving via your mobile device, please hit play before you set off on your journey. If you receive a message or a call while driving, either use a hands-free Bluetooth device to respond or wait until you've arrived at your destination. You're not just putting your life at risk. Distracted driving accounts for approximately 25% of all motor vehicle crash fatalities. Arrive alive.